Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
After about a year of peace talks, President Trump cancels a secret meeting with Taliban leaders at Camp David. What does it mean for America's longest war in Afghanistan, 18 years since 9/11?
Order.
Then, here in Britain, suspending Parliament, leaving critical Brexit questions unanswered. My guest, a senior aide to the former Prime Minister David Cameron, says Boris Johnson has overplayed his hand. Also, from Harlem haberdasher to Gucci partner, hip-hop fashion icon Dapper Dan speaks with our Hari Srinivasan.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. When President Trump canceled secret peace talks with the Taliban at Camp David this week, he exposed deep fault lines within his own administration. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and his chief Afghan negotiator Zalmay Khalilzad say the U.S. was on the brink of an agreement after almost a year of negotiations. On the other side, National Security Advisor John Bolton and Vice President Mike Pence opposed the deal, adding that hosting Taliban leaders at Camp David near the anniversary of 9/11 would be a public relations disaster. There are about 15,000 U.S. troops still in Afghanistan now, and President Trump was planning to bring almost half of them back after a deal was signed. This problem has bedeviled Presidents Bush, Obama, and Trump. Over 18 years, the war has cost nearly 2,500 American lives and thousands of Afghan and allied casualties. During this past year of U.S.-Taliban negotiations, one major stakeholder was not included: the Afghan government. Sadiq Siddiqui is spokesman for President Ashraf Ghani, and he's joining me now from Kabul. Mr. Siddiqui, welcome to the program. Can I start by asking you, first and foremost, was President Ghani invited to this secret summit in Camp David? Were you packing your bags and planning to go there?
Hello, Christine, and it's such a pleasure to be in your program. There were communications in the past few days of a possible trip to the United States so that the Afghan president can share and discuss the people's concern about a possible deal that was on the brink to be signed. So we had our observations. We had our concerns about that deal. And the president wanted to travel and share those concerns with the leadership of the United States.
Mr. Siddiqui, from what I kind of interpret you as saying, is that President Ghani, if he was going, was not going to approve a deal and sign a deal, as we understand the White House wanted, but rather to oppose this deal. Am I reading you correctly?
Yes. So, and the last days of the nine rounds of the talks between Mr. Khalilzad and the Taliban in Qatar, when he came to Kabul, so he briefed the Afghan president. And the Afghan president had his own concerns about that deal. So we asked for more details. We asked for those questions, answers for those questions that we had. At some point, the president, decided to travel to the United States or to take up this issue with the leadership of the United States. So in the past, 10 days, there was a communication between Kabul and Washington, D.C., so that we can discuss together this and present what we think of the concerns that are reflected from the nation, from the people.
Okay.
So that was something happening, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. So before I ask you about your concerns, I want to know why you believe this meeting was cancelled. Why did President Trump decide not to go forward?
Well, we strongly believe that the decision that was taken by President Trump is a genuine reflection of the concerns not only the Afghan people have in regards to a flawed deal or a deal that will only give elevation or leverage to a group that is heavily involved in violence. So that was our belief and still is belief. And also we believe that that decision is a very strong understanding of the concerns we share with most of those officials in the United States.
Okay, well, let me ask you this then, because the main bullet points of whatever Zameh Khalilzad has negotiated with the Taliban, we're putting on the screen right now, but they essentially include commitments by Taliban to counter-terrorism efforts in Afghanistan, a U.S. pullout from 5 bases within 135 days of such a deal, U.S. troop reduction from its current 15,000 to about 9 or 8,000, and what was not included was a ceasefire between the Taliban and the Afghan government, a ceasefire for Afghanistan. Are those the points that you disagree with? Are those accurate reflection of what the peace deal was about?
So we think that in those points, there are too many concessions that were supposed to be given to the Taliban. If they do not stop violence, so there was an immediate reduction of the U.S. forces. Imagine that in the 135 days, a big number of the U.S. forces will leave. But at the same time, there's no commitment by the Taliban to reduce violence, to cease violence. So what we are asking is for an immediate ceasefire by the Taliban. And the other issue was the direct negotiation with the Afghan government. So we've been stressing for the past so many months, so the sequence of these conditions have to reverse. It has to be, first of all, direct negotiation with the Afghan government. The other must be a ceasefire. And the third reduction, and finally, those other points. So there was lack of clarity in terms of the commitments by the Taliban made, especially, you know, assurance that they were supposed to give to the envoy that they will not allow the international terrorist groups to use those areas that they control against the U.S. But look at this. If the Taliban are so connected and linked to Al-Qaeda, to Haqqani Network, and many other regional terrorist groups, where did that assurance come? How do you verify those assurances? And what is the proper mechanism in which we can say that, okay, so Al-Qaeda and Taliban will not be linked? Whereas the number two of Al-Qaeda has pledged allegiance to the Taliban, and he is still standing on that allegiance. So there are a lot of things and concerns that we had and have in terms of Taliban's commitment, in terms of Taliban to change and stop violence. Mm-hmm. And then you will give them too many concessions.
Well, let me just put this to you then. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, or envoy is Zameh Khalilzad, said this yesterday on the Sunday shows in the United States, basically saying that, you know, they could reverse it if the Taliban doesn't meet its obligations. Just listen to him.
If the Taliban don't behave, if they don't deliver on the commitments that they've made to us now for weeks and in some cases months, the President of the United States is not going to reduce the pressure. We're not going to reduce our support for the Afghan security forces that have fought so hard there in Afghanistan.
So, Mr. Siddiqui, that is the Secretary of State of the United States on behalf of the President assuring Afghanistan and presumably your government that if the Taliban does not meet its agreements with the U.S., then the President will take action and won't withdraw all these, the support for the Afghan security forces. Was that not enough of a guarantee for you?
We have to be very clear in terms of giving the Taliban the messages. And also, we have to show them our commitment and our resolve toward a sustainable peace process. If you assess the past 10 months or 9 months, their position have been elevated to a point that they have been beating the drum of victory among their fighters across the country. So there's a lot of messages that were intercepted by the Afghan security forces that they tried to recruit more and more for the fight. So we saw clear actions by the Taliban that indicated that this group will never enter into a meaningful dialogue or will commit into a meaningful peace process. And they were just trying to somehow keep everything in a deceit. And finally, we'll say, okay, the U.S. forces are out of Afghanistan and we have been victorious.
Okay.
We strongly believe that position would have not been given to them unless they were not committing themselves to a meaningful peace process and end of violence.
All right. Well, what is your suggestion then as spokesman for the government to a legitimate question that the United States has? This has taken 18 years, trillions of dollars, thousands and thousands of lives on all sides. And we're no closer to seeing an end to this. Where does your responsibility lie? If there's no peace with the aggressors, if there's no deal with the aggressors, how does this end? And furthermore, Mr. Siddiqui, a new UN report says that over the past year, the number of casualties in Afghanistan have been created more by your security forces and international forces than the Taliban. So my question is, what is the government doing to end this war and to get the Taliban to stop its fighting?
So we are committed to end this war. We do have a roadmap, which the people have consensus on that. So there was a Grand Council meeting in Afghanistan. 3,500 people from across the country, they came to Kabul to give the president a roadmap towards peace. So we need international support to take this path forward. And, you know, and at the same time, we would like to see also an importance given and attention, more attention given to the South Asian strategy of the U.S. administration that will deal with the external elements of our security. The Taliban are still enjoying massive resources and support and safe haven outside Afghanistan. And Pakistan is one element in which the U.S. can put enough pressure so that they can also play an important and positive role.
All right.
So the roadmap toward peace is clear. We want peace. We want to end this violence. And we want a meaningful peace in which we can secure and bring this group, this violent group, into a settlement that will be lasting for a long time.
All right, Mr. Siddiqui, thank you very much.
Sector, yes, our forces.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much. I have to turn to my next guest, but I really appreciate you being with us. Sadiq Siddiqui, spokesman for the Afghan president. And now we turn to Saad Mohseni, who has major business interests in Afghanistan. He's CEO of the country's largest media company, and he's been informally advising the Afghan and U.S. governments in these negotiations. Saad Mohseni, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Can I just first ask you the question that all Americans ask? And you know very well, because you live in America as well as all these other places, and you're advising American senior officials around this issue. They're tired of it. There's so many Americans who've been killed. They have spent trillions of dollars. It's 18 years. And it's kind of in Afghanistan's interest to keep the troops there by hook or by crook. You get it, right? I mean, you get
Absolutely,
it that the president
yes.
wants to withdraw mm-hmm. the troops.
Yes. I think there's no one in the U.S. now who's insisting on keeping the troops in Afghanistan.
Well, there are. There's some people who say they must stay as a counterterrorism force.
That's a small counterterrorist force that helps the Afghan government deal with, you know, the rise of ISIS, the reemergence of al-Qaeda. But I think that everyone agrees, even in Afghanistan, that a major drawdown is inevitable. I think the concern that people have, both in Kabul and also in Washington, is in the manner it's conducted.
So let me ask you, because you have said this deal, which is now off, kind of threw you all under the bus. What do you mean by that?
I think the concern is that we get pushed under the bus. You know, we agree that there are conditions and they're fairly strict conditions, but there's also a timeline. So people looking at the U.S. elections and President Trump's instincts and what his priorities are, at the end of the day, the timeline gets priority over conditions. Mm-hmm. And the mechanisms, which currently, you know, they have written up and have shared with the Afghan government, the thing that I think really concerns people, again, both in Washington and in Kabul, is the lack of transparency, right? So, you know, you have interagency approach to these things, and in this instance, it's Secretary Pompeo, Zalmay Khalilzad, and pretty much no one else. They have even refused to share the document, well, up until recently, with Bolton. I mean, that's extraordinary.
The National Security Advisor. We know has been very against it. That's the reporting anyway.
He's pushed back on it, but same goes for NATO, same goes for the Brits, same goes for the Germans.
So they're all against this pullout?
No, they're completely in the dark in terms of what's being negotiated. And I think the concern that they have is we need more transparency.
And, of course, all their troops are on the ground. So let me ask you, because we have seen letters by former U.S. ambassadors to Afghanistan. They oppose the process and the complete withdrawal of troops. We've seen military generals and seniors from the United States, former, also joining this campaign to be very careful of doing a deal with the Taliban. You have been talking to many of these people, including people very close to President Trump, who President Trump trusts in the American Congress and military. Why do you think this fell apart at the last moment? Give us the anatomy of what was on the table and why a Camp David meeting fell apart.
I think it was just probably a combination of things. I think that there were still gaps in terms of what the Americans wanted and what the Taliban were committed to agree to. And I think that the hope was that they would bridge the gap enough for the Taliban to go to Washington, and then President Trump would be able to deliver what he wanted to, you know, has been wanting to deliver for some time, a peace deal in Afghanistan after 40 years. And I think the realization that they were not going to bridge that gap in Washington. And of course, you know, the 16 American troops have been killed since they started talking. So I don't think it's the killing alone that prompted the president to push back. But of course, a lot of people have also warned him that what if the Taliban don't abide by what they agreed to? What if they have a go at Kabul with 2 months before U.S. elections? What if these other groups reemerge? You know, and this during an election year is going to be very, very controversial.
And what about the idea that we've heard so much about, which seems sort of so counterintuitive, that you would have the Taliban, who after all hosted al-Qaeda, who are responsible for the incubation of the plan of 9/11, coming to Camp David, the seat of presidents and prime ministers and dignitaries, you know, within 2 days of the 18th anniversary of 9/11.
Well, I mean, with the benefit of hindsight, it's probably not the wisest of decisions.
But was there pushback on that? Was that part of what caused this collapse?
I think, well, probably in Washington, because I think a lot of people, like Senator Graham and General Keane and others, and General Petraeus,
who are quite close to the president,
or at least
Graham
have access to, yes, have, you know, are able to speak to him and communicate with him, and they must have warned him that this is absolutely crazy. The meeting with the Taliban in Washington was a lot of people were privy to that information going back 10 days. So they had the opportunity to probably address this issue. And I think that the president must have seen the light and realized that there were a lot of risks. I mean, it's not, you know, the Taliban, it's not North Korea, it's not Iran, or it's a terrorist organization. And many of these people are still terrorists. So to actually see them and meet with them before there's a deal and there's a commitment from the Taliban to distance themselves from the other terrorist organizations, it's obviously very risky.
So you saw what I played for Sadiq Siddiqui of Secretary of State Pompeo saying, you know, if they don't behave according to their commitments, the president will not let up his support of the Afghan security forces. And Mike Pompeo has also said, quote unquote, we've delivered. In the days since 9/11, we have, you know, got rid of al-Qaeda. Is that the case? Because, I mean, you heard Sadiq Siddiqui saying, actually, al-Qaeda still exists
Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda has reemerged in northern Afghanistan. We have groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba and other groups, Jaish-e-Mohammadi and of course, ISIS. You know, Afghanistan is a very difficult mountainous, you know, terrain and all that. Very difficult country to control. So without forces on the ground, whether Afghan or international, these groups will reemerge. No doubts about it. I think the concern that people have had is these organizations exist today. The Taliban are not able to control them in their own territories today. How will they be able to commit?
You're talking about ISIS.
ISIS, for example.
Yeah, yes. Because that's emerged as an even greater threat to Afghanistan today than al-Qaeda. Is that
correct?
That's
correct, yes.
And Taliban does not have the wherewithal to confront them.
And maybe they don't have a willingness to confront them. I mean, I think the information I was speaking to General Keane, who's obviously talked about this publicly, that, for example, the Taliban have informed al-Qaeda to keep a low profile until the Americans leave. And, you know, the American intelligence agencies are, you know, obviously privy to this sort of information. So there's that lack of trust in terms of what the Taliban are willing to deliver.
So let me ask you then, because I asked Mr. Siddiqui, I mean, then what is the route out of this? What is the route to getting the U.S. troops back?
I think first and foremost, they have to engage the Afghan government, right? So we're going to have elections end of this month, obviously.
We'll
have
in Afghanistan?
Well, it seems inevitable. Mm-hmm. The hope was that we would have a framework agreement with the Taliban that would then allow for the elections to get postponed. We're not going to see that now. So we will hopefully have a new government. That the Americans must engage the Afghan government. We are your partners, so to speak. We would say to the Americans, they should engage the Afghan National Security Forces, the Afghan government, and work through them in terms of negotiating this very important deal. And the other thing, which I think a lot of people are insisting on, is that if they draw down to 8,600 troops in the first 135 days, to keep them there until the other conditions have been met, not to rush into drawing down completely before October of 2020.
So, as I said, you are a major businessman there. You have the biggest media company. You have a very daring television station, Tolo Television, which has really bust all the boundaries of what an Islamic country like the Taliban's Afghanistan would ever even tolerate. You have women on television. You have soap operas. You have news. I mean, you give people absolute, you know, truth and a lot of culture from all over the world. What is at stake? In other words, most people think that kind of nothing has changed in Afghanistan. We're still where we were 18 years ago. What has been achieved that you are so anxious to keep American troops there to protect?
Well, there's a new generation of Afghans who are so different to the older generation. So the median age in Afghanistan is 18. It's the youngest country outside of Africa. And today, half the population lives in urban centers. More than two-thirds of the population has a mobile phone. Close to half the population is on Facebook or has access to the internet. So you're dealing with a much younger population. You know, the Taliban's approval rating has never gone above 11 or 12%. You know, so for us, for a lot of Afghans, the frustrating thing is that this peace deal is being imposed on us. And I think most Afghans agree that, yes, we need to have peace, but it has to be a just peace. We did a survey 2 days ago, 25,000 people voted. 75% of the individual surveyed said that they support President Trump's decision. Of course, this type of a survey is skewed towards people who have mobile phones and have access to technology, but it's so important.
They support which decision?
They support that talks should be suspended until the Taliban commit
so
seriously.
What do you think, then, are the most troubling bits of the proposal that perhaps the U.S. was going to sign off with?
First and foremost, lack of transparency, not working with the Afghan government. How could you determine as to how well the Afghan forces can defend the Afghan territory without consulting with them? I think that's one. Secondly, not engaging the government. They seem to be, you know, I mean, out of all the actors, they have more legitimacy than anyone else. I think that's very important. Thirdly, conditions are important, but how important is a timeline? I think the Americans have to say that we will not be as strict as we have indicated in terms of the timeline. And four, I think putting pressure on the Taliban directly and indirectly to talk to the Afghan side and to commit to agreeing to a comprehensive peace deal.
Saad Mohseni, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
So Afghanistan, of course, is a major focus in Congress, which returns to Washington today after its summer break. But here in Britain, legislators are packing up and headed home tonight, as Prime Minister Boris Johnson is suspending Parliament for the next 5 weeks in the crucial run-up to the October 31 Brexit deadline. They leave knowing they have received so-called royal assent from the Queen to block Prime Minister Johnson from crashing out of the European Union without a deal. Johnson met with the Irish Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, trying to resolve a major stumbling block, which is the Irish border. Varadkar warned him that a no-deal Brexit would be a disaster.
There are an abundance of proposals that we have, but I just don't think, if I may say so, I think it's entirely reasonable to share them with you today, Carl. We will be producing ideas for our friends and partners, not least here in Dublin, about how to take this forward. We have, I've indicated the areas in which we think progress needs to be made.
There's no such thing as a clean break or just getting it done. Rather, we'll just move on to a new phase. If there is no deal, it'll cause severe disruption for British and Irish people alike, not so much on the continent.
So, Camilla Cavendish headed the policy team for the former Prime Minister David Cameron, who called the Brexit referendum 3 years ago. She's now a columnist for the Financial Times, and she's going to be joining me here to talk about it. But let us play one more little piece of sound from Leo Varadkar, who essentially told Boris Johnson that what he was aiming to do was going to be a catastrophe. Just listen to this.
Prime Minister, negotiating FTAs with the EU and the US and securing their ratification in less than 3 years, I think is going to be a Herculean task for you. But we do want to be your friend and your ally, your Athena, in doing so. And I think the manner in which you leave the European Union will determine whether that's possible.
Well, Camilla Cavendish, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Essentially, that was Leo Varadkar very politely, with a classic throw to Boris Johnson's penchant for talking in, you know, Greek, Latin and everything else, talking about the Greek goddess Athena, who, let's not remember, was the one who stopped Hercules in his tracks from causing further catastrophes. What do you make of where we are right now, given that little bit of confrontation?
So, I mean, British politics feels like a roundabout that is just whirling around faster and faster. And actually, under Theresa May, it revolved quite slowly, but never got anywhere. Yeah. And under Boris Johnson, it's spinning out of control, but we still haven't actually got anywhere. And the point Leo Varadkar was really making is, actually, it's very hard to unlock the Irish backstop. There's a reason why it's there. And this is the sort of fundamental conundrum of Brexit. At the moment, nobody is budging. And, of course, Boris Johnson has underestimated how many Tories would rebel and leave his own party. And he's also underestimated the opposition, who he thought he could bounce into an election, and they are standing up against that.
So I think it's really interesting, this conversation, because first and foremost, you were in Downing Street with the Prime Minister, who, let's face it, brought us to this problem.
Indeed.
To this crisis. Yeah. Probably never imagining that it would be such a crisis. He thought that he would resolve the polar opposites in the Conservative Party. But instead, this is really bringing this country to crisis.
So, I mean, you can go back through history and find that Europe has been a running sore for a very, very long time. A lot of people would argue that you didn't need to erase it in this way. You didn't need to try and surface it. I think actually within the Conservative Party, after 2010 and then 2015, you had more and more Conservative MPs who were leavers, who were Eurosceptic, and the party was already becoming more Eurosceptic. So I think, you know, that was almost inevitable. What we are seeing, though, is really the end of the Conservative Party as a centrist broad church. It is now a sect which is essentially run by revolutionaries. They know they have to deal with Nigel Farage, who is on the right, who his Brexit party is polling at 12%. The Conservatives, I mean, under Boris, they're polling well, but they can't win an election, I think, unless they make an alliance with the Brexit party. That means moving to the right, and that's what they're doing.
So let's just talk about this. You've just called it a sect. I mean, that's pretty dramatic, right? But others, including rebels who've been purged or who've left, have said that it's going to move from being this broad party, broad church party, to a very narrow nationalist British party.
Yes. And well, nationalist English, really.
OK.
A lot of what we're talking about, I think, does go back to devolution, Tony Blair, the attempt to give more power to the regions. The Conservative Party, their leader in Scotland, Ruth Davidson, who was very popular, she has resigned. And in doing that, the Conservatives have probably lost all their seats in Scotland, certainly 10. And, you know, that is beginning to break things apart. It is English nationalism, really, which never found a voice and felt it didn't have enough power. And that is what we are now seeing.
So let's just go through a few issues. Election. So Boris Johnson continues to try to find the votes in Parliament for an election. He's unlikely to get it anytime soon.
Yes.
You have just said that. Do you think he could win?
I still think he could win. potentially. And this is where I think, you know, we're speaking here in sort of close to the Westminster bubble, if you like, where a lot of people voted Remain and they would like the country to remain. I mean, the truth is that the polls have barely shifted since June 2016.
Barely shifted?
Barely shifted at all. So for all the extra information that we've been given, for all the worries about no deal, at least two-thirds of people who voted Leave are saying, yeah, you know, I'm fine to live with no deal.
Whether Do they know what that means?
Well, whether they understand, I don't know, because, of course, no deal simply means you leave, then you're back at the negotiating table with less leverage, potentially. I'm not sure everybody understands that, but it is... we are getting entrenched, and I think there is a genuine question now, which is more dangerous, the threat to the economy or the threat to democracy?
But what's the threat to democracy? Which one is that?
Well, the deep anger in the country that the British people voted by a small margin, but nevertheless on a high
turnout, in other words, what,
to leave the European
Union. So what Boris Johnson says, if you don't let me crash out or go out one way or the other, that's an assault on democracy.
Exactly.
But you have written, and many others have written, that what Boris Johnson is doing is overplaying his hand, and that also is an assault on democratic institutions, on his party.
Well, you put it brilliantly. I mean, this is the sort of fundamental conundrum, and the worry is, in the end, do you get something worse? Do you get some kind of demagogue who comes through the middle? Because, of course, the Labour Party is also split. The Labour Party has also become a sect run by revolutionaries around Jeremy Corbyn. A large number of his centrist MPs are facing deselection, just the same way that the Conservative Party. This is the irony. We wouldn't be in this situation. It's almost unprecedented to have both main parties in disarray. If the Labour Party was galvanised and more centrist, I think it would have taken a firmer position on Brexit. We wouldn't be where we are now.
David Cameron's about to come out with his long-awaited memoir. You were in... Did you advise him against this referendum?
I was not present at that time. Luckily for me, in many ways, I came in 2015 after the decision had been taken. So I was there when the renegotiation was happening. Of course, the problem for David Cameron was he tried to renegotiate with Europe. He didn't get very far. And the truth was that I think there was an opportunity for Theresa May, just after that referendum, to have gone back to Brussels. They didn't believe that we were going to lose the referendum. Brussels just assumed people would stay in. And at that, the 3 months after that, they were in shock. Theresa May could have gone back and reopened the questions that David Cameron raised. She could have reopened the question of freedom of movement, which was hugely important for a lot of people in this country. They felt the scale of immigration was too great. They wanted to take back control. She never asked those questions. And that was a great lost opportunity.
Can I play a little soundbite from Amber Rudd, who is the minister and MP who's now resigned and given up and walked off with the other rebels. Yep. This is what she said on Sunday. Basically, she felt that she was, and the others were not getting an accurate picture of how much Boris Johnson was saying we're trying to get another deal.
What I have seen in government is that there is this huge machine preparing for no deal, which is fine. You might expect in the balance between getting a deal and no deal, 50-50 in terms of work, but it's not that. It's like 80-90% of government time going into preparing for no deal, and the absence of actually trying to work to get a deal is what has driven 21 of my colleagues to rebel, and I need to join them.
Now, what is the... I see you nodding to that. What is the advantage of a prime minister not putting his whole back into another deal? And with that question comes the fact that there's royal assent now. Apparently, he can't crash out with no deal. Is that correct?
Well, that depends on the EU. We always forget in this debate that actually this is in the EU's gift, and already France has suggested it may veto an extension. I mean, the EU are getting pretty fed up with this process. They're asking, you know, if you want an extension for 3 months, what's the purpose of that? Is it going to change the equation? We can't keep extending indefinitely. So that is in the EU's gift. But I think what was really significant about what Amber Rudd said was her really sincere sense that the government was not preparing in any serious way for a proper negotiation. And that, of course, again, Boris Johnson has to keep his right wing on side. He has to convince them that he is really serious about crashing out with a no deal. But if there's no real work, I understand his negotiating team is now down to only four people, if there is no real work to tweak the deal, then a lot of moderate people in the centre are starting to say, hang on, you know, this guy isn't really a leader. He's simply leading that sect. He wants to take us out. And people who thought he was playing a very sophisticated game, trying to keep his right wing on side, but maybe coming back to tweak the last deal, are now wondering whether he's just going to leave us adrift. entirely.
Just a quick question about his Emin Ask Rees, the infamous Dominic Cummings, about whom a television program has been made, starring none other than Benedict Cumberbatch. You know, everybody thought that he was the great Machiavelli. Has he overreached? Has he overplayed?
Look, I mean,
has it backfired?
I think advisers advise prime ministers. Prime ministers are the client, and prime ministers make the decisions.
Really?
I've known Dominic Cummings for many years. He's extremely able. He's a very smart guy. And he does intimidate. Boris Johnson hired him. He hired him primarily because he's a very good strategist and he's a brilliant election strategist, because remember, the focus has always been, the intention has always been to get an election, to break the deadlock by getting a majority. But ultimately, it's the guy in charge you have to blame, it seems to me.
I'm sure that's true, although we read that when people ask the Prime Minister questions, he says, ask Dom, i.e. the Dominic Cummings.
Yes.
But I guess...
But the great thing about this, Christiane, is, you know, we all watch The West Wing, right?
Yeah.
Anybody who goes into politics in Britain actually secretly wants to be in the West Wing. They end up being a character out of what we call In the Thick of It, which was a kind of British version, which is just full of kind of mediocre people who swear. And that is the terrifying prospect.
And very, very cynical and very,
very
aggressive.
Very cynical
actually.
And very aggressive.
Right.
And whether that's happening, you know, I fear that's what's happening in Number 10. It feels it's out of control.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's out of control because this seems to have left the Prime Minister with no majority at all. So he's losing and hemorrhaging he's lost his majority in Parliament.
He's lost his majority in Parliament. But as I said earlier, if he makes a pact with the Brexit Party, which I think he has to, he might still potentially win. Because remember, the other side is split. So, I mean, I voted to remain. You know, if I wanted
to
vote
Remain
again...
What if the other side makes a pact with all of those who want to stay?
They are trying to do that, but it's not assured. So there is a possibility that vote will split, and it will come down to tactical voting in individual seats. It will probably split five ways, and that's why no pollster can actually tell you what's going to happen.
OK, I was going to say, can you tell me what you think in 10 seconds Britain is going to look like after this process? Where do we end up?
Well, I fear we're going to look very bruised. I think Boris Johnson might get a very small majority, or we will have a hung parliament, and that is not going to resolve this issue. The logical way to resolve it is a second referendum. Unfortunately, I don't think either party leader actually wants one.
On that note, Camilla Cavendish, we'll continue watching. Thank you very much indeed. And while Britain continues to walk its Brexit tightrope, we hit the runway next because Fashion Week is underway in New York City right now. And we get a masterclass in style from the iconic designer Dapper Dan. Born and raised in Harlem, his legendary designs are inspired by the neighborhood he loves. Now, partnered with Gucci, Dapper Dan told our Hari Srinivasan how he worked his way up from nothing and what gives someone style.
All right, Daniel Day, you've got yourself a partnership with Gucci, a book deal with Random House, a picture deal with Sony. Not bad, you know, for a kid who grew up good at dice.
Yes.
Dealing, hustling on the streets.
Yes.
How'd you find the angle to be someone that stuck out?
Fortunately for me is that I'm the first generation of the great migration that came from the South. My father, born in 1898, so he arrived in New York in 1910, right? He's 12 years old. I didn't even understand that, you know what I'm saying? But only the strongest stayed. So we got the strongest black men coming out of Reconstruction from the South. Yeah. So my father was on that. So I'm growing up in that kind of atmosphere. Now, I got three older brothers and then two cousins upstairs. So I got access to all this knowledge, you know what I mean? All this energy.
Yeah.
And so that's what gave me the strength to be able to make it.
And you were one of the last generations to witness Harlem pre-drug epidemic.
Yeah. I remember a Harlem like 11 o'clock Sunday morning. You see everybody emptying out of their houses, everybody going into church. You know, you left your doors open. I saw Harlem when it was a village. So you found sections in Harlem. Everybody here was from South Carolina. You know, everybody over here was from Virginia.
So block by block.
What dismantled that kind of village feeling is when they start building public housing projects, and that took away from that. But that's not the Harlem I grew up in.
How did you get to be so good at dice by the time you were...
Gambling was the first thing I learned. And let me tell you why. We had what's called the rent parties.
Yeah.
A rent party is like you were in a circle of people, like neighbors, my father, neighbors and all that. And once everybody get a week that they have a party, and you said chicken, potato salad, collard greens, and they had gambling there, right? So as a little, as a young boy, I watched my father gamble, you know, and that's the first experience I had. And then my uncle Eddie, they called him Fishman Eddie, he had ran away when he was young and joined the circus. And there was a guy in the circus that taught him all these tricks with cards and dice. And so that was the first experience. That was the first thing I learned about street hustling.
Yeah.
But I took it even further than that, because when I learned everything there was that I could learn from the older guys concerning gambling, then I read all the books by John Sconi. John Sconi is the world authority for the United States government on gambling. He advised the government on casinos and everything.
Yeah.
He was the master. You know? So I got the street knowledge, and then I went and got all the book knowledge so that I can learn everything it took. So I was undefeatable.
Is there a moment you remember when the gambling turned into drugs?
I only knew of jazz musicians during the 50s that used drugs, but it wasn't a general thing, you know? And then it's the 60s during the Vietnam War, then it, you know, it escalated. It just spread out. And that's when we went through our first epidemic, and I got caught up in that.
Yeah.
The amazing thing was, like, me and all four of my brothers, we all got caught up into selling drugs. We all got arrested together. But while I was arrested, I began to read a lot and study a lot. And I wanted to know what happened. So as soon as I got out, I went to the library, County Cullen Library, which is part of the Schaumburg Library. I wanted to find out why this drug thing happened. So I studied the Opium War and what China did, the Boxer Rebellion, and then I became very political. And that was the end of that for me. I said I would never engage in something that would have that kind of negative effect on my community.
So were you born with a sense of style? Did you absorb it in the Harlem that you grew up in? How did it happen?
Let me tell you, listening to the older guys, watching them, like we have today what you call influences. Like, you know, hip-hop music create all these influences. But that's not a new thing. When I was growing up, I used to listen to my brothers now, and they would follow these Hollywood actors. And it had to be a particular actor. It had to be type of a tough guy actor who stands up against the system, and it's the way they dress. So my brothers and them used to pattern themselves back coming up in the 50s with Humphrey Bogart, George Raff, you know, all the ones who played them tough guy gangster roles. So everybody wanted to dress Edward G. Robinson, you know. And then later on, the style shifted to the Rat Pack, Sammy Davis Jr.,
yeah,
you know, and that. And then after that, I started developing a different style all alone by myself.
What defines style to you? When you see someone walking down the street, what makes you say that person has style?
Style is not a person. Style is a manifestation of culture that comes alive in an individual who represents that culture. You know, when you look at the jazz musician, you know, the way they might just take a hat and toss it a certain way or use colors a different way, you know? So that's what it is. It's like, first it's the culture, and then out of the culture comes the style. I always tell young designers, interpret the culture, because that's going to make a difference, you know?
So how did you get the money to start the store?
You want to learn? I'm going to give you a new term. In Harlem, there's what we call flatfoot hustlers. A flatfoot hustler is a person who can wake up in the morning broke and come home with money. You know? So let me show you how that works, right? In Harlem, all over Harlem at the time, we have what's known as street crap games. And it works just like Las Vegas. Somebody controls the momentum that takes place in the game. So you put your money up, he put his money up. So I get up in the morning, I get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, I go and I take some dice and I put it down the street. That makes me, I'm the casino, I'm the one conducting that. Everybody pays me to participate in that game.
You're the house.
Yeah, I'm the house man.
And the house always wins.
And the house always wins. And so I generated money like that because I refuse to go back and to be involved in any drug culture. In addition to that, I wanted to engage in things that wouldn't hurt my community. So there's in Harlem, there's another game they call the paper game. The paper game is checks and credit cards and that. And so I delved into that for a little while. You know what I mean? Because I felt like big banks, you know, I felt like John Dillinger, you know, everybody rooted for him because he wasn't robbing people. He's robbing banks, you know, you know, and there's something special when you could take a pen and rob a bank. You know, and so that's what the paper
is. So this is fraudulent checks, fraudulent credit cards, dice games.
Yeah, yeah.
That is your seed capital to start
exactly
the store.
Yes.
So you set up shop, and how does it occur to you to take global European brands and putting your own spin on them? You call them knockups, not knockoffs. What does that mean?
A knockup is when you take a brand, interpret it to your culture. And to them and to the world, eventually, it looks better than where it started from, you know? And so that's what I do. How did I do it? I did it by this. One day, a guy came into the store, big gangster, top-notch gangster in Harlem, you know? And he's affiliated with John Gotti, brother Gene Gotti. He came in the store and he had a pouch, a Louis Vuitton pouch, full of $100 bills, you know? Everybody's excited about that pouch because it's Louis Vuitton, right? And I say, it's only $5. I say, that's, you know, I'm dealing with fabric. I know what that's worth. You know, production-wise, it's like $5 worth of vinyl. But I say, what is it? I say, it's the symbols. It's the symbols on that pouch. So I said, those symbols had as much power as the fur coats that I was making and the plongé leather jackets that I'm making. So I said, if I can take them symbols and put them on leather and have my clients looking like luggage, that would have the same effect as if I made them a fur coat. And so that gave me the idea to going into doing what I'm known for today, Logomania.
So how did you get LL Cool J and Eric B. and Rakim and Salt-N-Pepa to start wearing your stuff?
Well, it was a new genre. They couldn't pay me. Some of them still owe me money to today. But so here's the birth of a new fashion ideas coming along, right? Logomania. So when the rappers started to come, they're looking for a new look, right? And this new look. So now these designer bags and stuff like that is popular. There's a new musical genre that's popular. So Eric B. Rakim and LL Cool J, the rappers is making a lot of money and they want their own look. So I started giving them their own look and that's why they started coming. I started giving them the Logomania look, you know, the Gucci, the MCM, the Fendi, the Louis Vuitton.
So how do you get a look for a person when you sit down and you start talking to them before you design with them? What are you looking for?
That's an important question.
What makes a jacket an LL Cool J jacket?
That's an important question because you know what? In fashion, it's hard to stay relevant. And my way to address that is every person that came into my store, we designed together. I asked them, how do you want to look? How do you feel? What kind of message do you want to send? So I'm not designing completely from my mind. I'm translating a cultural aspect of how they represent themselves. So that's what I did with fashion. When they came in, one of the significant things, and that's important that you mentioned Eric B. and Rakim, because when you look at one of the most famous jackets that I made, the golden black, when Eric B. has his on, he has the Gucci sign on the back. When Rakim has his on, he has his religious symbol on the back. So everything I created, I use these symbols, but I design them in a way where the customer feels this is the look they want to have.
So you're almost describing to me in a way that fashion is also about power.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Fashion is about power. And that's why I always tapped into that. That's why to start out with, I said, what my clientele is going to be? Middle class people of color are not going to buy it from me. This is like, no, we going to Gucci, we going to Louis. But the gangsters, my first clientele, they didn't care about whether it came from these designer houses or not. If it was cool, they was going to wear it. So what I did was I tapped into the power. You know, the gangsters, they were the stars in the hood. So everybody wanted to look like them, and the rappers wanted to look like them. The strength when I was designing was the popularity of those who had the most money, and that was the gangsters. So I designed with them in mind, and I start with them.
So did it give you pause? Here you are making money in the shop, mm-hmm. and you're dealing with gangsters. They're making their money. Really, they're profiting from someone else's pain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you're benefiting.
Yeah.
That's how you're keeping your family fed.
Exactly. Yeah. But you can't be in it and not of it, you know? And so it's without realizing I'm a product of those who I'm dealing with, you know? So I'm wrestling with that. And I'm really not happy, but it's with being in the street on that level, but I like what I'm doing. So eventually, what happens is, which is always what I've seen happen with the drug game, it implodes. The drug community starts fighting among themselves, killing among themselves. They look around. There were so many people selling drugs, so nobody was really making any money. So as a result of that, they start looking at other people. I'm open 24 hours a day.
Your shop was open 24 hours?
My shop is open 24 hours a day, 365 days. For 10 years straight, you know? And so there's a lot of kidnapping going on and robbering going on, and they attempted to kidnap me. And I resisted, and I got shot, have a bullet in my neck. And then after that, I recovered from that. Then the brands, a result of me using trademarks, then the brands took notice.
So one of the lawyers who came in to basically help close your shop.
Yes.
She's working for Fendi.
Yes.
Her name is?
Yes. Sotomayor. Yes. She's a justice of the Supreme Court today. A wonderful lady. I have to say that day. I remember the day she raided me. She came in this store, and I just finished a coat for a popular rapper, Big Daddy Kane. And it was a aquascutum, like a full-length aquascutum cocktail with a tuxedo black glamour collar. Black plongé leather with black on black Fendi logos all over it. And she seen that coat. She said, this is amazing. This guy really belongs downtown. But of course, she raided me and they took all the Fendi stuff out. Yes, Sotomayor. And as a result of that, the raids kept coming like that there. So I closed down and went underground.
So what happens when you go underground?
When I went underground, right, I had already built up a clientele for all the gangsters and hustlers in all the cities in the United States. So what I did was I would make up clothes and go from in New York to Chicago, hitting all the black cities, and then come back to New York, and then go from New York to Atlanta, hitting all the black cities. And that's how I sustained myself for 20 years underground.
So 20 years, fast forward, Gucci rolls out a piece. Social media goes bananas because mm-hmm. it looks so similar to what you designed for an Olympic athlete 25 years prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that really helps you restart.
Yeah, it's amazing because Gucci says, look, we had every intention to let the public know that this is Dapper Dan's creation, you know? We just took it for granted. Everybody know they meant, you know, and I take them for that, to pay homage to me. And it was paying homage, right? And they just didn't say it in the beginning, but they just took it for granted that everybody knew. But Black Twitter went in on them. Mm. But they said, that's okay. So what Gucci did, they came to me, got in touch with my son. I said, are they serious? He said, yeah. I said, no, they ain't serious. He said, no, Dad, they want to talk to you. They want to do the deal. I said, no, they ain't this. I don't believe it. I said, tell them come to Harlem if they want to do. And they came to Harlem. All right? I said, I don't want no collaboration. What do you have for me? They said, we'll give you a partnership. And we'll open up an atelier in Harlem where you can do everything that you've always done, but you just use our fabrication.
And now you're legit.
Yeah. And you know what really got me excited? They said, we know that the world knows who you are now. All right? And everybody's paying you homage, but nobody paid you. So we're here to change that. And that's what this deal is about.
So you're working with Gucci. Then there's this balaclava incident where they roll out a turtleneck that basically looks like it's blackface.
Yes.
What goes through your mind as soon as you see that?
Well, as soon as I see that, you know, I'm a student of history, especially black history, right? I know that this wasn't intentional. But intentional or not, if you shoot somebody by accident or you shoot them on purpose and they die, they're still dead. You know, so I tell Gucci, I said, look, I had to announce to the public because now my community is up in arms. I'm up in arms. So I said, look, I'm a black man before I'm a brand. Gucci, I want you to come here and explain to the community what happened. I trust that this was an accident. Marco Bazzari, the CEO of Gucci, came to Harlem and we sat down. We said, this is what we're going to do. We're going to put money in this community. We're going to develop designers. Now we have like two vice presidents of color in working for Gucci. They came with this whole program, and I took that program and I ran with it, and I let the community know this is what Gucci is doing. And I think this is phenomenal. This is like we have a global footprint now.
Ironically, 25 years ago, you were actually exposing these European brands to consumers that they were never going to reach anyway. They had no interest in reaching. Because they also didn't think that that consumer had money. And all of a sudden they're saying, wait, how do I reach that?
Yeah, the hip-hop artists couldn't even pay me back then. Now you have Jay-Z. He's a billionaire now. Hip-hop has been a billionaire. They're the influencers for the brand, you know? And so it's a complete turnaround.
Dapper Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes.
Dapper Dan, expanding styles and imaginations. But that's it for now. Remember, you can always listen to our podcast and see us online at amanpour.com. And you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.